Okay, let's get going. How's everybody doing? Keeping dry? No.
Here's your receptacle right after the desk.
Okay, well, I want to thank everybody again for their excellent presentations last Thursday. How many people did not have a chance to review their team comments that I sent out yesterday? Excellent. You got all of them. All right. So I want to talk a little bit about them as well. I went through them all, and the comments I thought were very good. A lot of them were right on. A lot of them, there were multiple comments about the same thing, so they must be doing something. They evaluated them similarly. A lot of people talked about the problem, the importance of involving users came up quite a few times. Prototyping early, keeping the design simple. Some people actually had sketches about designs and stuff, so that was pretty interesting. And everybody was really excited about seeing the final result. So that was good. So I want to know from the students if they found the comments useful, if they thought they were fair, or they're a little confused about them or whatever. So if somebody has anything to say about that, you know, let me know. Anna, did you have a chance to look through the comments for your team?
I did. I thought they were very insightful.
Good.
I think the comments were a great idea.
Okay. Something that you can use?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I was excited that people said they were excited to hear it.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, it's another thing, you know, in 3 weeks we're having the final presentations will happen here, so that's, you really have to use your time wisely because it's your most valuable resource. So a lot of times in looking over the comments, you might get one comment and you don't know if it's something that you should incorporate into your project or not. Sometimes you'll get comments one way and one the other way. So in my mind, they sort of cancel out. And a lot of times you don't know if the comments are something that you should really pay attention to or not. So if that's the case, you can talk to me. I'll be able to help you out. Did anybody get a comment that sort of misinterpreted what you were trying to do or sort of the reviewer didn't get it? No? Everybody thought it was good. Do you have any comments about your evaluations?
My comments were more how accurate it is in terms of presentation. I didn't necessarily comment, but that was helpful.
Did you have a chance to look over the comments? Yeah. Okay. So if you have any questions about these comments, please come and see me. That would be good. So midterm reports, I'm expecting them today. End of the day would be okay. If you need more time, you can request it. Assignment number two, there's a webpage link to that I sent out last Friday. I also have a PDF of the same thing that I'll send out as well. And does anybody need that in printed form? I sort of hesitate to print it out, you know, for all the teams, but if that's the way you want it, I can send it. So next Tuesday, a week from today, we have another field trip. We're going to go to the motion and gait analysis lab in Menlo Park. It's not far from Willow Garage. So there's sign-ups here for carpooling. So during the break, you can come up here and sign the attendance sheet and sign up for a ride if you need one. And if you have a car and are willing to drive students, that would be great. Let me know. There'll be another opportunity to sign up on Thursday. And then one last thing. This is sort of a critical time for team projects in that you have a very short time left, and you really have to decide how to focus your efforts. You know, what are you going to do? What concept are you going to move forward with? What are you going to concentrate on? What might you, leave, put aside? So I think it'd be great for all the teams to arrange to meet with me so we can discuss these kinds of things. So please do that, this week arrange to meet with me either sometime this week or early next week. That would be great. You also have to think about your final report and presentation, so keep that in mind. I think you guys did a good job in practicing for your midterm presentation, and it was very satisfying to see how well you did. So that was great. So continue to send me updates and continue to take photographs of what you do, because there will be good things to put into the final report and in your presentation. So Thursday, I'm so excited about this. We're going to have a little assistive technology fair. It's going to be right outside there. And the weatherman says it's not going to rain. So that ought to work out. So this is the first time I've had this. I'm a little unsure how it will turn out. But I actually have 11 vendors coming now. And these are going to be people that are bringing stuff. And I should mention that all these people know our businesses. And I told them that you guys don't have the money to buy anything. You don't have a need to buy anything. So they're here just for the students and the community members. So they're spending a couple hours not making money. They're not making any money. This is just for educational purposes. So you should be very thankful to them when you see them. It'd be a chance for you to check out all the stuff that they sell. These are all products that they sell. Some of them are low-tech ones. Some of them may be a little bit higher-tech. We saw the six-dog trailer in the video. I also have a chance to meet a service dog. Isn't that exciting? So I suggest that you go around and visit every table and maybe go around with somebody else from the classroom and maybe somebody that you that isn't on your team, somebody new to you. Go around, and it's a good idea to sort of bounce ideas and your thoughts with that other person. So go around in with a partner that you don't know, and check out everything. Okay. Yeah.
I've got a question.
Sure.
I know this probably doesn't relate to anyone else, but so North Coast Medical makes the device which we're trying to improve.
Yeah.
So would it be possible or appropriate or wise to talk to them say we have these improvements on your design.
Right.
Are you interested in collaborating?
That's a good question. There's a number of companies that are called catalog companies that sell a lot of products. They don't necessarily make them all, but they resell them or whatever. They're always looking for new products and better products and things that they can sell. So it would be okay to approach them and say that you're working on something and they might be very interested.
If we could make a deal with them, could the money go back into this course or to other assistive technology initiatives at Stanford?
It's complicated.
I don't know what I'm doing.
We have to go through the Office of Technology Licensing.
Okay.
And we have to talk to them so we can go through that. And you're an undergraduate? No, you're a graduate.
I'm leaving here in 4 weeks.
You're leaving? Where are you going?
I'm a graduate. To the working world.
Oh, okay. Making some money. Kevin.
Brings up an interesting question. Say one of these bright young folks says something interesting. Who owns the intellectual property?
Okay. That's
short answer.
Short answer, Stanford has first dibs. Okay. But, and then it gets more complicated from there. Okay. So, we had a whole talk on intellectual property a few years ago, and we also had somebody from the Office of Technology Licensing here. But the Office of Technology Licensing only is interested in stuff that they can make millions of dollars on. So they're not going to be interested in this stuff. So they'll
make themselves an obstruction.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's a pretty strict system, but there's ways to get not ways to get around it, but there's flexibility. Okay. So today we're going to talk about robotics. I'm going to talk about assistive robots, and Professor Okamura is going to talk about movement therapy robots. So I want to get started with that because it's all going to be interesting. So this is our agenda. So a couple weeks ago we had a medical robotics conference here at Stanford, and one of the things that I gleaned from that is how to classify robots. So their top classification is industrial robots and medical robots. And the medical robots could be further classified as surgical robots and movement therapy robots and assistive robots. And under assistive robots, there's three types. Mobile servants, these are devices that assist in grasping and picking up things, aid in feeding, cooking, and all the activities of daily living. A physical assistant robot is a robot that provides walking assistance, like computer-controlled prosthetics or exoskeletons, and they may be wearable-type robots. And the third type of robot are things that provide mobility, like cars or wheelchairs or devices to transfer from one place to another, from like bed to a wheelchair. So these are just a way of thinking of a hierarchy of robots. So what image comes to mind when you think of a robot? Well, there's lots of robots that we deal with. You know, some of them are in cartoons and movies. Some of them are real, some of them are not real, some of them are industrial, and some of them look like cars, and we have seen R2-D2, and some that look like real people, and some that look like real people but are really robots. And we've seen the Beam telepresence robot and the PR2 already. But the one that's most common is the Roomba. You wouldn't think of that hardly as being a robot, but it is. And they sold over 1 million of these things. So this is the state of popular robots that are around. Okay, some abilities that a robot might have: to move, sense, manipulate, mimic. So that includes an appearance and also performing tasks that a human might do, like assembling an automobile or, assembling computer chips or boards or stuff like that. The ability to communicate, to think. It has a computer on board. You might think they might be self-aware. The ability to be programmed, the ability to react and respond to different situations, maybe unique situations, and of course, it would have to do something useful. But I guess there are, toy robots that are for people's amusement, but amusement is something useful, I guess. So, as far as an assistive robot, I think it's a device that can sense, process information, and perform actions that benefit people with disabilities or older adults. So that's pretty general and inclusive, I think. A lot of people could use a robot, including those who've had a spinal cord injury, who have cerebral palsy or arthritis, older adults, people with some progressive diseases, stroke, if you've had a fracture or a strain or something, a temporary impairment, maybe you can use a robot to help you get around. Amputees certainly can use robots, and we'll see some of those. So starting at the beginning, this is an exoskeleton type robot that was actually attached to a wheelchair, and this is made from Rancho, which is in Southern California. Maybe not the best kind of robot because you had to be in the chair in order to use it. So, what year?
Yeah.
I would say maybe 60s or 70s, before you were born, probably. Here's a robot that's on a desk that you can control with a probably a mouth stick. So it can, you know, pick up papers for you and stuff like that. It's a very simple gripper type robot. And you can see it can move up and down over here and up and down this way, and maybe this gripper and other things can move. So another very early robot design. I worked at some robots with some robots over at the VA. This is the MOVAR, and the MO stands for mobile. So we built a robot with these three wheels that I talked about a couple weeks ago. These are omnidirectional wheels, and there's a bunch of electronics in here, and here's a Unimation robotic arm with a gripper, and this gripper was made by the guy locally who did the whales and Free Willy for the movies and Star Trek. So that's sort of famous. And here's a camera on it. So with this robot, it provides remote manipulation. You can control it from a distance, and there's a radio link that you can control it by voice. And again, this is probably early 80s, and also by using that head control mechanism that I showed you on the ultrasonic wheelchair that I did. So that was another input device. Okay, another huge project that we had involved using a robotic arm as a way to manipulate things around you in a vocational environment. So who knows what these big CD-looking devices are? These are called video discs. So it actually had video on them. So here's a guy who can control the mouse and press the keyboard. He's not able to use his hands, but he can control this manipulator by voice. And it knows where the things are, knows where the mouse is, knows where these papers are, knows where these video discs are, and it knows where the printer is. So it basically is interpreting commands and translating them into movement commands for the robot, which is hanging on a track underneath, above the desk here. So they've employed a commercial robot to do this stuff. Here's another view of it, the arm, the rest of the robot on a track across here. This is a safety on-off emergency kill switch. And there was in later designs, there was a little microwave oven here that the robot could actually twist the dial and put things into the microwave and pull things out and serve the person, soup or food. So that was a part of this desktop assistant robot made for on-the-job use. And we actually installed one of these at the Pacific Gas and Electric up in the city for a user. Other assistive robots that I've seen, these are from the web. I didn't work on them. I showed you other examples of robots that can help in feeding and cosmetics and washing your face and stuff like that. And here's another one of them. Looks like it may be controlled by this input switch down here. There's a bunch of these robots that are mounted on wheelchairs, because if you're a wheelchair user and you drop something on the floor, it's hard to pick it up. So people have had robot designs that are mounted on a wheelchair. This is an early model. Manus is still in operation. I'm not sure that they've sold very many of them, but it's controlled by this keyboard here, and it adds a lot of weight, to the wheelchair. And here's another design, and here's a third design of a wheelchair-mounted robotic arm. You can also add a lot of instrumentation to a wheelchair to make it robotic in nature, so that you don't run into walls, or you can control it if you have a high-level injury. And here's one that has a bunch of ultrasonic sensors around here, presumably to find where the obstacles are, and it's supposed to be an add-on kit. But with a lot of these things, people have done research, and this may be just a one-off prototype. Another, So here's what happens if you try to make a wheelchair into Stanley, you know, a self-driving car. This is like the self-driving wheelchair. You got your, you know, laser rangefinder here, proximity switches. You got all sorts of other cameras and stuff up here. But this is somebody's research project. I've never seen this, built. Here's another more advanced, more appealing version. Still has a bunch of ultrasonic sensors on it. And the way this one's supposed to work is it, you tell it where to go by, it tracks your eye position. So you point with your eyes, which really isn't the best way of getting input, but they've done it. I've also seen wheelchairs that are controlled by a brain-computer interface. So those kinds of things are out there now as well. This is a sort of interesting project. This is not a robot, and it's sort of a cross between a walker and a wheelchair, I guess. But what this does is it only allows you to move in the direction where there's no obstacle. So if it prevents you from going into the wall, so only will let you steer in the direction where there's a free path. So this has gone through a number of steps, but it's not on the market as far as I can tell. So a lot of robots in the news today. We know about PR2, and you know, last year it can you know, get a sandwich for you. It can probably make a sandwich by now. We've seen how the robot can be programmed to do all sorts of different things: fold clothes, set a table, bake cookies, play pool, stuff like that. So very, very flexible. And they're starting to sell these. In fact, there's an article out now that Willow Garage is getting into a new mode of business where they're going to focus more on selling these rather than doing research on them. So that's sort of interesting. And we've talked about exoskeletons. There's a bunch of different companies making these kinds of devices. And this is essentially a robot that you wear so that if your legs don't have the strength or are paralyzed, they can help you walk. And this one is up in Berkeley. This is one that was done by a student team to help out a student. So that's sort of interesting. But again, it's just a project. It's not something that you might find on the market. It takes a long time to get these things on the market. So, and a long time means a lot of money. So if human strength isn't good enough for the army, then maybe you can wear a robot to make you more successful at doing a lot of push-ups. So, or carrying things or whatever. But so there's an active research in the military to come up with exoskeletons as well as robots that would carry things for you on its own. And then there's things like this that can help improve one's sense of touch. I put this in there because it's sort of unique. We don't normally deal with sense of touch, but it could be important for some people. So it's a sensor that translates what it feels into vibrations based upon roughness, I guess. This is a robot from USC, and what this is doing is leading you in exercise. So it's your exercise coach, and it's watching you to make sure that you're moving your hands in the right direction and everything. So that's sort of unique. And there's a bunch of these robots that are telepresence devices. There's some that connect to the internet that you can see the doctor's face on here, move it around, talk. Some of them have arms, some of them don't. Some of them may remind you, when to take your medication, bring the medication to you, things like that. This is sort of unique, a hair washing robot. So, makes your leaves your hair silky smooth. I wonder how you evaluate that. I think this is a Japanese version. So it's funny. And then on the Transformer type theme, we have this bed that part of it turns into a wheelchair. So that's it. So you don't have to transfer from a bed to a wheelchair because you're already in the bed / wheelchair. So that could be very useful. But again, it seems like it was just a prototype. Then there's prosthetics that you wear that can be considered robots. A lot of these are very smart. That can tell, you know, your knee when to flex, your ankle when to flex, and keeps up your pace. A lot of these are on the market now, and they're getting better and better. We've seen robotic hands and arms, some of them funded by the military. This is an older version. This is probably a newer design concept. I wonder if it comes in. Wonder if you don't like red, I wonder if it comes in another color. You know, I wonder if it could be customized. I thought this was pretty unique. Giant teddy bear robot can pick you off the floor. Actually, this is a very interesting task. You know, moving people around when they're bedridden, moving them from one place to another is very important. A lot of times, you know, if people do it, there may need to be more than one nurse around, and you know, people hurt their backs and things like that. So something like this could be very useful, but I'm not sure this is on the market yet. And then there's robots that serve as therapy robots, so it provides something warm and cuddly for people to hold, and some of them, you know, purr and, you know, move their eyes and stuff like that. And so it's, you know, made for elderly, if they have a certain stat, you know, you have to rely on a robot doll instead of human contact, but there's a bunch of these things around. And then, of course, robots can be used in the classroom by everybody. So, in summary, we've got a lot of different ways you can find robots. They can be used to help people with disabilities. A lot of research is being done. You know, a lot of them are just one-of-a-kind prototypes, though, that, you know, somebody does a research project and they come up with one. But it's a big step to come up with, you know, one that's sort of interesting to something that's on the market and can really help people. But so there's very few assistive robots in common use today. Still waiting for that. And people don't know. It's all going to cost a lot of money. You know, who's going to pay for it and what kind of benefit people will get out of it are some of the factors to consider that are barriers to adoption. So any question on this stuff? I went through pretty quickly, and I'll send you more stuff on robotics as I find it. So there's usually a couple articles every week on how robots can be used. Yes?
My name's robotics, though. Do they completely do the task for you, or do they wait to see some sort of initiation from your own robot?
Well, some of them are programmed to be on a schedule, like they'll know what time of day it is, and you should be taking your medication at this time of day, but it's up to whoever designs it. There's some that you have to, you command, you tell it to help you, that you command it, and others that are maybe even commanded by, you know, by a telepresence, by somebody else down the street.
Well, I was saying in the case of bending your arm or something like that, do they use an EMG sensor or something like that to see when you're trying to flex your arm?
Some of them can work like that, right. Yeah, a lot of them use residual EMG from the part of the arm that's still there, and to do other things like grasp and operate the elbow and wrist if that's a part of the prosthetic. And some of them actually work on switches that are in your feet. So I've seen robotic arms that work on foot switches. So that's sort of unique. So anyway, we'll take a short break now, and Allison will set up, and she'll give her talk. So stand by about 3 minutes. Yeah. Well, hold on. I should just turn this off. Thank you. It's a what?
A tiny computer. You
it's
have.
A netbook.
So does it, what kind of processing does it have, or is it pretty much only used for playing?
It can do, it can do everything. I think Matt Olin has one of these that he uses as a standard computer. I mean, he has an external monitor. So. Good. Let me give you the microphone.
Are you taping, or is it just...
Yeah, I'm taping. Because there's some students that that do this online.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Let's see.
I should have a note and advice to the speakers about wearing clothes that they can fit. Try to go through it fast.
No, actually, this is plenty of time.
Okay. Sorry.
Sorry. Technology, whereas here the focus is flipped, and so I usually get really good questions about what's real motivation and the advantages that robots might have in these areas. So please interrupt me, ask questions while I'm speaking, or feel free, I'm going to try to leave a little time at the end for questions as well. So I'm going to talk about movement therapy robots. So in contrast to what Dave talked about with assistive robots, where you have robotic devices that aren't going to necessarily improve your health, but they are there to help you accomplish the activities of daily living, that's in the assistive robotics category, movement therapy robots, the idea is to actually provide therapy to improve a lost function, not by, say, replacing a limb like a prosthesis, but actually improving one's health through a therapeutic activity. So movement therapy robots, let's first just think about what are some types of patient groups, types of people that could benefit from movement therapy robots. So any thoughts? Yeah. Yeah, stroke. And that's the biggest one, at least in terms of
incidence, how many patients there are per year, and the type of economic impact that stroke patients have on our country. Any other thoughts? That's right. Actually, yeah. Yeah, injuries and orthopedic issues are very common, particular. Yeah. Any other thoughts? Yeah, spinal cord injury as well. Yeah, definitely. Sorry? Drop foot? Yep. Okay. Great. Those are all great examples, and I think we've hit on the most of the big ones. So stroke is the biggest one. So many people who are in this field of movement therapy, robotics, are concerned about designing systems that will help stroke patients. Stroke is very challenging, though, in part because when someone has a stroke, you know, that is, you have usually a hemorrhage in the brain, you have blood where it shouldn't be, and you lose function because of that. But every stroke patient is different. Different parts of the brain have been affected, and if someone has problems making their movement because of a stroke, it is not necessarily easy to connect the deficit that you see with what happened in the brain. And therefore, stroke therapy robots have to be extremely patient-specific because every patient is different. And this is a big challenge for sort of automated systems, which robots are. Cerebral palsy is another big one. Not an area I was familiar with, but that's kind of the second most common area in which people would like to apply rehab robotics. Orthopedic interventions, of course, another big one. After trauma, after surgery, knee and hip replacement, etc., are all common orthopedic interventions that are desired. So I'm going to focus mainly on stroke because that's where the vast majority of rehab robotics focuses. So to rehabilitate someone after a stroke, when someone has a stroke, it's not just the idea that their muscles have become weak or they're just physically lacking in some capability. Stroke has actually damaged the brain in a way that the normal neural circuits that cause movement are no longer there. But you don't completely lose hope when you have stroke because people are really amazing at rebuilding the pathways in order to accomplish tasks. But that takes practice. You can't just sit in bed and think about recovering from these sorts of devastating occurrences. You actually have to make movements in order to reconnect these neural circuits. So creating movements and reconnecting neural pathways in the brain is the goal of stroke rehabilitation. And to do that, you need to have quantity. So you have to say, how often should a person practice? Duration, how long should they practice? What is the intensity of repetition? And what kind of tasks should people be doing? Are they task-specific movements? Or are there sort of general stroke rehab activities that would be good that can generalize from one task to another? And I would say these are all variables that people think are important to an optimal rehabilitation, but in part because of the difficulty that every stroke patient is different, every patient has a different issue, we never know in advance what is going to be that optimal thing for a particular patient. So that makes this especially challenging. We all know that these are important things, but we don't know what the right answer is for optimality for a particular patient. Now, what can a robot do to actually help accomplish these variables in rehabilitation? Well, there are some different strategies. So one might be to assist the movement. So if I want to move my arm from here to here, the robot can actually help me move. So let me ask you a question. If a robot helps me move from here to here, do you think that is actually going to help rehabilitate someone or not? And it's actually kind of controversial. So thoughts? Yeah. Yeah. Great. So it may depend where you are. You know, are you a chronic stroke patient, or is this an acute thing right after you've had the stroke? It may depend on the kind of learning that's needed to reconnect the missing neural circuits. So just to go further on that, for assisting movement, so you might think, okay, assisting someone to move may help them because it helps them see what the right movement is. If they can't even volitionally create that movement, then it's hard for them to recreate the neural circuits because they have no way to connect the motion of the arm to something that they desire to do. And so if you can tell the patient wants to move to a target and the robot pushes them there, then that could help. But at the same time, it's not as if the patient is generating the muscle forces that are actually generating the movement, and so there's definitely something missing there. So that brings us to the next one, which is challenging or resisting the movement. So now imagine that your patient wants to move to this target, and they're trying to move there, but the robot is actually pushing against them and preventing them from moving there. Why could that be useful? Any thoughts? Yeah. Yeah, and so strength training is part of it, but what if it's just not strength? Maybe it's not a muscle strength issue. We're talking about reconnecting neural circuits here. Any other ideas? I would say that's true, but maybe more of an assistive context. Like, definitely in an assistive context, the robot might want to prevent someone from doing something dangerous. But in this case, we're trying to get a patient to reconnect their neural circuits and actually help them move independently. So how is resisting might help them? Let me try one more thing. Right. And for... Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, focus is definitely part of it. Yeah.
Okay,
Yeah, that's true. Sometimes you could think of that as assistive as well, but correcting bad habits, so sometimes more, I guess, on the assisting movement part, people will create sort of force channels, so the robot will, maybe it's a planar robot that lets you move anywhere in the plane, but it provides forces so you can only move in a particular direction. You could say that assists them from only moving in the directions that they want, but not in directions that they're not supposed to. So that might be more of an assistive technique. Did you have a comment, Dave? Yeah.
I was thinking that maybe it's not training the muscles, but maybe it's training the brain.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and that's a little bit to the focus that was discussed earlier. Yeah, so you're really going to want patients to try harder. And sometimes the kind of movements that you might make it where you're sitting, say, in an exoskeleton robot that's being used for rehabilitation now, for movement therapy, not assistance, is that if a patient just wants to move from here to here, well, maybe they can actually do that okay. But if they were really doing an activity of daily living and they had to be pushing this chair from here to here, then you might want to actually resist their movement to recreate the dynamics of the real environment that they might have to interact with. So moving in free space is not the only thing you want to do. You're often going to need to interact with forcefully with the environment. Simulating normal tasks, so I guess this also gets to this point. If you just want to create a simulation of moving around real objects, then you just may want to simulate those dynamics. Yeah? Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. And there have been various strategies that people have tried to help that. So maybe they start out assisting and they move more and more to challenging. And maybe I'll give one other example that it's pretty specific. But there are sometimes patients who, if they're supposed to move on a target to a target from here to here, and I can make this very nice straight line movement, but patients, due to the incorrect neural circuits, might move in a sort of opposite, in a curved path when they should be moving in a straight path. So the resistive movement could be pushing them even further along that curved path, and so they start realizing, oh, I have to push against that curved path. So it doesn't necessarily frustrate them so much as force them to realize even what they're doing wrong. And so if they start pushing against this even more curved path that the robot's trying to pull them along, when you take away the robot, then the person might actually wind up moving straight. And then, yeah?
So our project actually focuses on stroke victims and having some level of paralysis in their body. So what you were talking about makes me think back to our meeting that we had with someone who's rehabilitating after stroke.
Uh-huh.
And so he's limited to the motion in one arm. So he can only raise his arm up to here. And even doing that has been something where for years he's had to reprogram connections to be able to make this. And one thing that he said to us that was really interesting is that he said, well, like, obviously here I am, I'm working against gravity. And he's like, but there's ways that you can use it to work with you. So he's like, for example, if I lay down on the floor, I can make this motion and go all the way back. Uh-huh. It's interesting because he's almost using the environment as
assistive technology. Yeah, that's a really great point. And gravity is a particular difficult thing. So often stroke patients will have these what are known as synergies, where when they move part of the arm a certain way, another part of the arm will kind of automatically move, even if they didn't want it to. So you get this coupling between different muscle groups that wasn't intentional but just occurred. And especially when you're fighting against gravity, I have to use certain muscles to keep my arm up, and then that automatically might activate a synergy that also brings this joint in, even though I didn't want it to.
When he brings it up,
yep.
It up like
yeah. Uh-huh. And so some of the assistive techniques actually just use a robot to remove the effect of gravity, and then at least allow them to exercise some of the other neural circuits that normally can't be exercised because you're spending the whole time fighting gravity. And so sometimes assistance just removes gravity, and practicing without gravity can help them regain movement that can then later on remove those synergies and later on be translated to normal movement. Great point. Non-contact coaching is also something, I think this may be more of a little bit more on the assistive side, but the exercise robot, you know, helping you to move a particular way, that's also, of course, a form of rehabilitation. But, of course, a lot of the real strength of robotics is that they're physical devices that can physically interact with you. If it's non-contact coaching, you could argue that, oh, maybe it should just be a video of someone telling you how to move. It doesn't necessarily have to be a physical object, although I'd say definitely some researchers argue that the physical embodiment of a robot creates social context that gets a user to be more engaged with the therapy. Okay, so I'm briefly going to just give some examples, sort of like the eye candy pictures that Dave was showing, of some different types of rehabilitation robotic systems. And I've divided them up into these categories, which these came from Mike Vanderloos, a mutual friend of mine and Dave's, who's done rehab robotics research for decades. And he sort of set it up as this timeline of how people in the research community and rehab robotic community have sort of viewed rehab robots evolving over the last couple decades. And the very first rehab robots were replicating the therapist, and then they augmented, and then we call the super therapist, and then there's the latest idea is this inner therapist. And that gets a little bit to your point back there about people resisting or being upset at the rehab and how do you get people's emotions and feelings about the rehabilitation to change. So I'm going to step through examples of each of these. So this first phase is replicating the therapist. And so here's some examples of robotics that have attempted to do this. So here's an example from the Palo Alto VA Hospital /Stanford. I think, Dave, you were involved in this research, right? So he'll know more about it than me. But the idea here was a mirror image movement enabler, where what you did is with your intact, your good arm, you could create commands, say, I want to move right or left, and then the robot would move your other arm in the same way. And the advantage of doing this, rather than just having a robot autonomously move your arm, here it's like you're teleoperating your damaged, your weak side. The advantage of doing this is you still got your kind of neural pathways acting in that as the patient, you are thinking, yes, I want to move this way, and you are therefore causing your arm to move. It may not help in particular with issues like strength, which can still be an issue, but at least you're engaging your own thoughts about where you want your arm to move, and even if you're not making that arm move by itself, you're sort of teleoperating it to make it move. So that's one system. It's a bimanual system. There is a company that came out of MIT called InMotion, which has made, I would probably call this, at least for upper extremity, the most successful commercial rehab robot so far. And when I say most successful, I mean maybe used in a few dozen therapy centers around the world. So most successful here are small numbers. There are not a lot of these systems that are actually out there. And this is one of the few systems where they've actually done very complete studies with patients and looked at tests. So, for example, Fugle-Meyer is one clinical measure of patient movement capabilities, and actually showing that training with this very simple planar robot arm and doing tasks like hitting targets, either with assistive or resistive behaviors, that when you follow their particular regimen with this particular robot, that people would actually regain functionality after stroke. And now I guess is a good point time to point out that there is sort of a difference between the robotic device itself and then the rehab strategy that it uses. One rehab robot device, like this one, could apply forces to the arm in the plane and measure motions that are in this plane, but what it does with them is entirely up to the programmer. And so you can't necessarily dismiss it and say, oh, this robot is good or this robot is bad. It's the combination of the robot and the strategy it uses and then all the particular details, like 4-week regimen of daily 1-hour sessions, that may actually result in success or failure of rehabilitation for a particular patient. And I probably shouldn't even use the word success or failure because it's all a continuum of how much rehabilitation you can get. But that's probably the most successful system. Another research system, this is from the Rehab Institute of Chicago, which is one of the biggest groups in the U.S. that studies rehab robotics, is more of an exoskeleton type of design, which allows you to move much more than systems. Well, most systems that are planar kind of allow you to move like this, but there are, of course, a lot of tasks where you need to move in a plane like this. And they even have versions now that also swing out that give you true 3D motion of the arm. And in here they've used this with all sorts of different types of strategies, just an example of another device. Okay, so these are many of the earlier rehab robots designed where the way in which the strategies were used were much more like replicating the therapist. Or what a therapist might do. Augmenting the therapist is doing things that a human operator or a human therapist couldn't do. So the other robotic device and the way they've been used is, I could sit down next to a therapist, they could grab onto my arm and move it around, and it, using a robot isn't necessarily a very different experience from not using the robot and using a human therapist. But there are some, particularly compelling environments that you can create with a robotic or haptic type interface. Haptic means a touch-based interface, which will be able to do things that a human therapist cannot do. So here's another example from the VA, which Dave, I'm sure, is very familiar with. And Larry Leifer's group was involved in this as well, where it's a driving simulation being used for rehabilitation. And so I think I have another slide on the details. So, but the main idea is that it's a 1 degree of freedom therapy device. So you're just supposed to turn this wheel, and you're playing this game. So games and virtual environments can be very motivating to patients. Even if they're challenging, it can make it fun. It becomes a game, and you get visual rewards or auditory rewards that make you happy that you're succeeding. And this is an example of one way in which you can do this. So what they did here is they took a steering wheel and they split it into two halves. And so you could separate out the weak half from the strong half, depending on where the stroke was in the brain. And you could, for example, get people to try to apply equal forces with the two hands, and only when you apply equal forces does the car respond correctly to your movement. Or you could completely ignore one half. Maybe you ignore the strong half and you base it completely on what the weak half is doing. And you can make all these changes without the user even necessarily even realizing that the environment and its reaction to the input is being manipulated in some interesting way. Other types of devices that have been used. This is a device called the Haptic Master. It's a 3-degree of freedom haptic device that's designed to move the arm around or apply forces to the arm. And they've also used here sort of very novel virtual environments that make rehabilitation more fun than it might be otherwise. And then there's this idea of the super therapist. And not necessarily my terminology, but this is what we mean. We mean systems that can really do things, record data and respond to the human user in ways that you could never imagine a human therapist doing. This is so far different from just practicing in a virtual environment. And this is sort of a funny slide, but let me walk you through this carefully. This gets back to this idea that you should resist people's movements and therefore get them to react in the appropriate way. So here's an example. So here's a stroke patient, who is supposed to be moving along a particular path. They're supposed to be moving to a target. But their movements are not a straight line path. They're these very, you know, very fast. They overshoot, they come back, they have a very erratic behavior. So this is their baseline, and it's unperturbed, and this is just their current natural movement. They move in this strange way. And then B is what we call late machine learning. So in this case, what it's doing is saying after looking at lots of movements of that patient, it computes what forces would I have needed to apply to that patient to make them move in the ideal way. So when you move in a certain way, you have certain muscle torques and forces that are causing your hand to move that way. And so what the machine learning system does here is it computes what is the exact sort of opposite of those forces and torques that the user is actually applying that would get them to move in a straight line path. And it's not really very interpretable, but this is what this represents. And then in early training, late training, this is the idea that now the patient is actually moving under these machine-learned forces. So the robot is actually applying forces to them, which is resisting their movement, in this case, trying to make them worse and seeing if they'll recover. And then what happens afterwards, this is E, this is called the after effect. So once you remove the robot forces, and now the patients, you know, you think they should be back at baseline. So you think you've removed the robot applying these forces, they might go back to here. But instead, that because they've trained in this environment, which applies these other weird forces to them, they manage to wind up in the end having very straight movements. These other ones are after you remove the forces, how it happens over time. I have to say that these plots here, they make it look pretty good. Like, okay, you can train in this weird environment, and then suddenly your bad movement, your deficit completely disappears. The truth is, there's two caveats to this. One is that this doesn't last very long, actually. Your adaptation to these sort of strange forces that cause you to move really well for a while, it goes away pretty quickly. And so what they're calling early and late washout, it's still all within, you know, say 100 reaches. If you bring them back the next day, put them in the same robot, they're kind of back to where they were at the beginning. So it's promising in that you can show that at least temporarily you can get them to sort of rebuild the right neural circuits and move correctly. Researchers haven't really found a way to make it stick. The other issue is that context is really important. When someone sits in front of a robot, and for a particular screen with their arms, say in an exoskeleton robot, a lot of the movement learning, the neurological learning that you've done, becomes associated with that particular system. And so as soon as you walk away from the robot and try to make those same movements in the real world, even if it's 2 minutes after having trained and done very successfully with the robot, you might lose it all. Okay. So I collaborate with someone that does gait retraining of patients with damage to the cerebellum, and they walk on this split-belt treadmill where part of the treadmill moves faster than the other side, and it's amazing. Patients, after a while, and healthy people, will adapt very quickly to this strange split-belt treadmill and kind of figure out a gait that makes it look kind of normal, and then if they just step... If you take the treadmill and they start tying the belts together and they're no longer at different speeds anymore, then they walk funny for a little while. But if instead of having them tie the belts together, you just have them completely step off the treadmill, they don't walk funny for a little while. They immediately remember what they move like in the real world, and they just start walking normally again. And so the context is very important to people associate the learning with the context. And this is one of the big challenges, I think, in rehabilitation robots, is that even if the robot can teach you lots of stuff, if your brain associates everything you've learned with sitting in that robot, and you don't want to be in that robot all the time, then you may not have truly learned it in a way that becomes useful in your activities of daily living. So there's some kind of impressive results like this, but I just want to make sure you have the caveat that this is by no means a magic bullet for rehabilitation. Other examples that are more sort of in the super therapist category are trying to solve this issue of context by creating rehabilitation environments that are sort of in virtual cave-like environments where you really feel like you might be in the real world. So now the subject, if they can stand, will be standing. They get very immersive visuals. It's no longer, you know, a little screen. You no longer see your arm in the robot or holding onto the robot because now all of that is covered up by graphics that represent the real world. So some of trying to repair this issue of context is to make robotic training environments that seem very, very realistic. I would say that this is really still kind of a cutting-edge research in rehab robots, and we still don't know if we have a good way of transferring, you know, the context of the robot to the context of real life. So this last point, this latest phase, and I would say it's only been the last couple years in rehab robotic conferences, we see this sort of inner therapist idea. And all I mean by that is that you have to consider how the user's emotions, their feelings, their amount of tiredness, their amount of engagement should affect the way a rehab robot behaves. So we want to be able to engage the person as much as possible. So these are just some examples over the last few years of papers that are actually starting to look at how does a particular patient feel during the rehabilitation process. And what, there are many, many models to describe how people feel and what their emotions are. But here's one example, which is kind of interesting. It compares valence on this axis and arousal on this axis. And so in this sort of planar description of the way people feel, which is, of course, a gross simplification, but is for analytical purposes, it's useful, you could say, oh, someone with high arousal and maybe very negative valence, they're kind of on the angry side, right? Or let's say now you have negative valence, but your arousal is so very, very low, maybe you're sad. And if you have both, if you have low arousal and kind of medium valence, then you might be sleepy. So those are just some examples of ways that people are trying to model how patients feel as they're going through a rehab process. Now, how do you actually sense this information? Well, you can sense heart rate. You can sense skin galvanic response, like the amount of sweat that you might have. They also use EEG caps that measure like the amount of brain signal happening, and people have found ways to try to map those sensor data to these kinds of emotional attributes. Okay? All right. So most of what I talked about before in all of these examples were upper extremity robots, which are the types of systems that I've worked with in the past. But I also thought I'd just show you a few pictures of lower extremity robots. For example, walking aids. I'm just going to flip through the pictures quickly. Locomat is probably one of the more successful commercial systems. It provides gravity compensation while people learn to remove their lower limbs in the correct way. And here's another a group that's actually looking at balance training. So they actually have someone stand on a big platform which can rotate them with respect to gravity, and there's foot force plates underneath the feet to help measure whether people are actually applying their correct forces to regain balance. Those are all examples of lower extremity. Now, I want to make sure to leave time for questions. So I'm just going to review some of the current projects, recent projects in my lab very quickly, just so you can see an idea of a research project, which is not necessarily rehabilitation, but looks at some of the basic neuroscience that would guide towards rehabilitation. And the example I'll give is a project in collaboration with someone at Johns Hopkins, Sandy Krieger Institute, where we are looking at people with cerebellar injury. So the question is, if they move like this due to injury to the particular part of the brain, can we make them move like this? So this is moving in a center-out task to different targets in a star pattern. Okay. So we're looking at patients with damage to the cerebellum, which is a particular part of the brain, right down here, which is thought to house a model, an internal model of the body's dynamics. So if I make a fast movement from here to here, and I do that quickly, I'm not able, because of that quick movement, to use feedback, visual or proprioceptive feedback, about the movement in order to change my behavior. Instead, I have to, in advance, plan, these are the muscle torques that I'm going to output that I can quickly use to move my arm from here to there. And it's hypothesized that the reason cerebellar patients move like this, as opposed to controlled subjects that move like this, is because they've lost that dynamic model of their bodies, because they're housed in the cerebellum, and the cerebellum has been damaged, either due to a genetic problem or due to trauma. Okay? And the reason why we like to study cerebellar patients, as opposed to general stroke patients, is because there are very specific, you know, the cerebellum is just one specific part of the brain. And if our goal, say, on the neuroscience side, is to understand how do particular deficits in the brain lead to deficits in movement, then we kind of would like to pick apart and just look at one part of the brain at a time. like I said, general stroke patients are really complicated. So we look at patients who are have movement deficits, but their diagnosis is more simple. It's more concrete. We know what it is that's wrong with them. So what we've done, actually, let me show you a picture of a cerebellar patient or a video. So this is one of our cerebellar patients at Johns Hopkins, and he's doing a task where he's doing a nose-to-finger task with one of my grad students, or a chin-to-finger maybe. And you can see that his movement is, it's not in the straight line path. And actually, if he moves slowly, he can actually do it very well, but the faster he tries to move, the more the unknown dynamics of his body perturb him from the desired movement. And many cerebellar patients are affected on both sides. Okay. All right. So I'm just going to actually skip ahead over some of these details. This is just sort of a case study of a particular research project. But I want to know what we've done with patients like this. Is we've had them sit in a very simple, looks complicated, but it's an exoskeleton robot. Really, it just allows the two arms to move in the plane. And we have people make reaching tasks to different targets. And like at this example here, you can see the control subject moves very differently from the cerebellar subject. And also you can see that depending on the direction of the movement, the cerebellar subject may be better or worse. And you can imagine, because when I move in a direction like this, I have a lot more of my arm moving than if I move in a direction like this, right? And so when there's more dynamics involved, the overshoot and the curvature is worse than movements where there are not many dynamics involved. So what we can do is we compute these angles. We know about the dynamic properties of the body. We can back out the motor torques that were required to create those movements. And we can test hypotheses about what went wrong with the control in the brain. And I'm not going to, I apologize, go into all the details about that control, but one of the interesting findings from this research is that you can look for a specific patient and say, aha, there is a particular error in their dynamic model of the body which is causing them to make that incorrect movement. And therefore, you could have a patient-specific approach to helping them relearn the dynamics that they're missing. So that's the big picture there. The caveat here is there's definitely trial-to-trial variability that these patients have, and while we can correct their bias using these rehab strategies, we haven't been able to correct their variability. They still have some variability, which is not something that we can fix. Okay. I think I'm going to go ahead and stop there and just conclude with this thought about medical robotics in general. Rehab robotics also includes work I do in surgical robotics as well. And the number one thing is that we need quantitative descriptions of patient state. And this is maybe one of the great unstated advantages of robots, is that you can record all kinds of data. You can constantly be recording data when a patient is interacting with a robot. You can record their motions, positions, velocities, you can record their forces, you can record their speeds, and you have a huge wealth of data that allows you to quantitatively describe how a patient is behaving at a particular time, and then create models that can be used to really target an optimal intervention for that patient. So as opposed to just randomly trying different things, you can look at this data and say, this is what this patient needs. That's ideally what we need. With stroke patients, we still don't always know what those models should be, but robots are at least a first step to helping us build those models. And then once you have those models, you design devices, systems, processes that actually connect this information to an action, to an intervention. And to me, this bullet here, this is the definition of what robotics is. Dave showed a slide with all kinds of pictures of different robots. The definition of robots that I like to use is this bullet here. And then they should incorporate human input in a natural way, but these are all only the technical challenges. There's many social, regulatory, et cetera, issues to building great rehab robots. Okay, so I'm going to stop there, and I know I only left a couple minutes, if anything, for questions, but let me take them now. Yeah. Mechanical engineering. Yeah. I'd be happy to talk to people after class if you want more information. Sure.
That'd be awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Whatever.
I was wondering if you had any information on, like, water.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, water therapy is a great point. It gets to her point earlier actually about gravity compensation, because the buoyancy of the water can compensate for the gravity, and it helps a lot too. In addition, like I mentioned with cerebellar patients in particular, if they move quickly, then that can be a problem for them. And so moving in the water creates this viscosity, which helps them move slowly. It's not necessarily a rehab strategy, but cerebellar patients really enjoy being in the water because it prevents them from making the fast movements, which make them move so erratically. So they actually just really enjoy it. But I think one of the main things is removal of gravity or decrease of gravity being the main reason why water therapy is so useful.
I
remember, I saw your awesome video on the website.
Thank you. I've been testing this device for 3 years, and I've seen improvements not only with the device, but also how my body reacts to the device. And primarily, the two things that I am receiving from it is the increased amount of proprioception. Because my condition is paralysis, spinal cord injury. And prior to using a robotic leg, my walking device for crutching is tripod. And with the robotic leg, bringing me upright, increased my proprioception on my back side.
I see. Do you think that's because it's aligned your joints in a way where it's more easy to sense movement?
Right. And not only that, it's on my balance that I'm not afraid to fall backwards. And secondly is because the motors are an index in the knee flexion, it incorporates the patterning. So the stimulation of that pattern registers through my brain and converts it down the system. It creates a loop. And then when I'm not using the robotic leg, I remember that patterning and that loop, and I can articulate my knee flexion as robotic and then soften that application to my leg so I'm not walking like a robotic. When I first tested it, I started walking like a robot and still pretty much programmed that way. The gait training on it is not a hip flexion this way, but more of a sideways step. And we walk that way.
Oh, it does kind of a side and forward. Okay, yeah.
But on top of that, though, besides the focal perception, for rehabilitative purpose, if somebody's using a chair a lot, it definitely puts you in an upright position and corrects your
So do you think it has rehab implications? But rather than just being in the assistive system, I say just, I mean, it's a really amazing system, but do you think it has implications then for rehabilitation? Because, that's great. Have they tested it in that context yet?
Right now we're testing the previous product that's out on the application is basically symmetrical. Now, I'm working with physical therapists and design engineers and movement, and we're talking about the asymmetrical patterns of the body. So we're engaging into testing one side is going to be stronger than the other side. So the stronger side is going to be on a fixed formula, and then the weaker side more on assisted, so it can go back and forth. It's not there yet, but just the fact that test pilots like myself show improvement along the plane, then they're saying, okay, the body is definitely symmetrical in ways that the robot needs to be programmed directly.
That's really interesting. Thank you very much. I think I better stop here because we're already over, but feel free to come down and talk to me, ask questions. I'll stick around for a while. Thanks, everyone.